This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here, we enlighten you with the ayah 61 of Surah Yunus, recited by Ahmad Mirzad Waqifi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. وما تكون في شأن وما تتلو منه من قرآن وما تتلو تعملون من عمل إلا كنا عليكم شهودا وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا في السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا في كتاب مبين وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا في السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا في كتاب مبين صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. And you are not engaged in any affair, nor do you recite concerning it any portion of the Qur'an, nor do you do any work, but we are witnesses over you when you enter into it. And there does not lie concealed from your Lord the weight of an atom in the earth or in the heaven, nor anything less than that, nor greater. But it is in a clear book.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines. Iran's president says the Shanghai Cooperation Organization is able to counter unilateralism and views of its vast potentialities and geographical expanse. South Africa's parliament votes in favor of downgrading the country's relations with Israel over the regime's deadly crackdown on Palestinians. Clashes once again break out between Peruvian police and people protesting against President Dina Boluarte in the capital Lima. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Iran's president says the Shanghai Cooperation Organization enjoys extraordinary capacities which enable it to play an effective role in countering unilateralism. Ebrahim Raisi made the remarks in a meeting with the organization's Secretary General Zhang Ming. He said the organization can also promote regional and international cooperation in view of its immense manpower and geographical expanse. Raisi said the organization members can boost trade cooperation through exchange of expertise. Zhang, for his part, welcomed Iran's membership in the organization while stressing Tehran's important role in regional peace, stability, and development. The SCO was founded by China, Russia, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan in 2001 and currently forms the world's biggest regional market with 8 official and 4 observer members. Israeli forces have carried out a deadly raid on the city of Jenin as they intensify crackdown on Palestinians across the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian Health Ministry says 6 people have been killed and 11 wounded by Israeli forces there. The ministry says 2 of the injured are in critical condition. The raid targeted a house in the Jenin refugee camp. Israeli media say a Palestinian suspected of shooting 2 Israelis near the town of Huwara has been killed in the raid. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas issued a statement later in the day expressing condolences to the families of Palestinians killed in the Israeli raid. Hamas said the Israeli crimes and massacres will not intimidate Palestinians, but will make them more determined to confront the Israeli forces and settlers. We asked author and political commentator Mazen Rumsia why Israel won't end its deadly attacks on the Palestinians. Here's what he had to say.
Indeed, this is what's going on is basically continuing assault by the Israeli occupation army on the Palestinian civilians in the claim of trying to get some wanted people. This is what started the whole process, is actually raids in Jenin and Nablus that killed many people. And then there was this one young man, 26 years old, I believe, who in retaliation went and killed 2 Israeli settlers, colonial settlers, who are illegally here in the West Bank. And this continues basically the rolling the ball down the road basically of many Palestinians killed for 1 or 2 Israelis killed. This is typical of the Israeli actions in the occupied territories.
South Africa's parliament has voted to downgrade diplomatic relations with Israel, citing the regime's violation of Palestinians' rights. The National Freedom Party introduced a draft resolution. It said that Israel was created through the displacement, murder, and maiming of Palestinians. It said the regime instituted apartheid to control and manage Palestinians to maintain its grip on power. South Africa's relations with Israel have been tense in recent years. The recent decision comes as more than 70 Palestinians have been killed by regime forces in the West Bank alone so far this year. The regime also goes ahead with its settlement expansion in the occupied land and keeps its blockade of the Gaza Strip. Pakistan has marked the birth anniversary of Imam Mahdi XII. Shia Imam people took part in special gatherings across the region to celebrate the occasion. Nasser Kazmi has more to tell us in this report.
They lit up the sky with fireworks. This is one of the main traditions in Pakistan when it comes to marking the birth anniversary of the 12th Imam of Shia Muslims, Mahdi. Imam Mahdi, known as Imam of Time, was born on the 15th day of the month of Shaban on the lunar calendar around 1200 years ago. Imam Mahdi commands special respect among Shia Muslims who believe he will someday appear on the earth as per divine decree, establish peace, and rid the world of injustice, discrimination, and other instances of evil. In Pakistan, people decorate and light up the streets and gather inside mosques and other religious sites nationwide to celebrate the auspicious occasion.
The Islamic world is facing lots of challenges and hardships in the present time within and outside. Unfortunately, Muslims are being used by the Zionist enemies against their own brothers in the name of sects or religion. This is a time when we are looking forward to a savior like Imam Mahdi, who will come and lead us out of this anarchy and will lead us to rid the world of oppression and injustice.
Every year, thousands of Shia Muslims attend the birthday celebrations of Imam Mahdi with passionate tributes and distribute votive offerings. They find Imam Mahdi's birthday a chance to pray to God to save them from evil powers and to bring peace and justice to the world.
We are here to celebrate the birth anniversary of Imam Mahdi. This is a very special day for all Muslims around the world because our Holy Prophet promised the advent of the last Imam Mahdi, and everyone is waiting for that day. Because when Imam Mahdi will appear to this world, there would be justice and peace everywhere.
Besides arranging mass gatherings, people also wrote letters of love and affection to Imam Mahdi during the night of 15th of Shaban for the fulfillment of their wishes. They also call for global unity and solidarity among Muslims.
While using the occasion to reaffirm their allegiance to the last Shia Imam, Pakistanis believe that Imam Mahdi's birthday is a great opportunity to remind Muslims of their duties against tyranny and oppression. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Ukraine has extended a request to the United States to provide it with banned cluster bombs to use in the war with Russia. That's according to two U.S. lawmakers who serve on the House of Representatives Armed Services Committee. Jason Crow and Adam Smith say Kiev has urged members of Congress to press the White House to approve the weapon shipment. It includes anti-armor bomblets Ukraine plans to use against Russian forces by drones. That is in addition to 155-millimeter artillery cluster shells Ukraine has already requested. Cluster munitions banned by more than 120 countries normally release large numbers of smaller bomblets that can kill indiscriminately over a wide area, threatening civilians. Russia has censured U.S. officials' assumptions without investigation that saboteurs were behind last year's attacks on Understream Nord Stream gas pipelines. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov has once again called for an urgent and transparent probe into the incident. Peskov said recent media reports are a coordinated effort to divert attention from the real culprits. His comments follow a report by the New York Times that a Ukrainian group might have carried out the attacks on the pipelines. The report presumed that the saboteurs were most likely Ukrainian or Russian nationals. or some combination of the two. Moscow has been pressing for an international probe after a U.S. investigative journalist alleged Washington to be behind the incidents. The U.S. has rejected Russia's claims, saying that Moscow is trying to distract the world from the war in Ukraine. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has made an unexpected trip to Iraq. He met with the Iraqi Prime Minister and is expected to meet with other senior officials. We've discussed the trip in our news review program.
And now it's time for news review. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has made an unexpected trip to Iraq 2 weeks before the 20th anniversary of the U.S.-led invasion of the Arab country. Well, the Pentagon chief says his visit is aimed at reaffirming the strategic partnership between Washington and Baghdad. After meeting with the Iraqi prime minister, Austin said the U.S. troops are ready to remain in the Arab country at Baghdad's invitation. Now, the U.S. attacked Iraq in 2003 under the pretext that the then Iraqi regime under Saddam Hussein possessed weapons of mass destruction. The claim, however, was later found to be false. Tens of thousands of Iraqis were killed as a result of the invasion. Washington now has 2,500 troops in Iraq. That has resulted in turbulence and paved the way for the rise of terrorist groups there. In 2020, Iraq's parliament voted to expel American forces from the country. I'd like to welcome my guests to this news review. Edward Horgan, activist and commentator out of Limerick, Ireland, and Firas Al-Najm, human rights activist out of Toronto. Well, thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start this off with Edward. What did you think of Austin's visit? What was he trying to say or trying to prove in your perspective with this visit?
Well, I suppose the reality is that in recent years, in recent decades, the U.S. has lost the Vietnam War, it has lost the war in Afghanistan, and effectively has lost the war in Iraq also. As you mentioned, there were no weapons of mass destruction. The reason for the 2003 war was a bunch of lies. It was about resources because Iraq has a lot of oil and still has a lot of oil. So the U.S. is trying to maintain its arguably illegal occupation of Iraq. It is also illegally occupying an area of northwest Syria. And clearly it has left many countries, including Iraq and Syria especially, in chaos. It has also been imposing sanctions, which in the case of Iraq during the 1990s caused the deaths of over 500,000 children under the age of five. And this was confirmed by the United Nations. What we're seeing in reality, in my view, is the US, which has less than 5% of the world's population, is trying to enforce the equivalent of a criminal protection racket at global level, using NATO as its enforcer. And this is a gross breach of the UN Charter and international laws.
Well, Firas, the Pentagon chief has said his visit is aimed at reaffirming the strategic partnership between Iraq and the United States. Your perspective on that and what he said?
I mean, there is no real strategic relationship with Iraq. It's been chaos since the day that the Americans got involved inside Iraq and invaded Iraq. We're going into the 20th anniversary, and we've seen how much instability there is in Iraq, and how much they have influenced this instability inside Iraq. They don't care about the sovereignty of Iraq. They don't care about the nation of Iraq. They don't care about the government of Iraq as well. And we've seen that especially when ISIS took over masses of different areas and occupied it, that terrorist organization, Daesh. And, the Americans didn't help in any way. If anything, they were supporting the ISIS groups and empowering them and giving them weapons and things like that. And they were just pretending as if they wanted to help and fight the terrorists there. And adding to this as well is when they broke the international laws and the laws of Iraq, when they killed Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mehdi, and he was Qasem Soleimani, an Iranian general that was invited by the prime minister of Iraq at the time, Adil Abdul Mahdi, and he had a personal meeting with him, and he was invited to him, and they killed him beside the international airport of the Iraqi country. So you know, this is an airport that is used by all civilians inside the country, and they just breached all the laws, violated any kind of respect that they had or any agreement with the Iraqi government. So this shows you they don't really have any strategic partnership. If anything, they're there to destabilize Iraq, to disunite, especially Iraq, from the Islamic Republic of Iran. That's the main important and key ally of the Iraqi government and the Iraqi people. We've seen that especially in hard times when, like I said, when ISIS took over or when the Americans took over, that the only true country that was supporting Iraqi people and supporting the fight against the occupiers, and that is the Americans, was the Islamic Republic of Iran and its leadership. And they're trying to cause a rift, and they're trying to cause damage between the relationship. And they have influenced certain groups on the ground in Iraq. But, we have very wise leaders inside Iraq that know the benefit of Iraq. And, the Iraqi parliament voted for the Americans in 2020 to leave Iraq. So there shouldn't be any military presence inside of Iraq.
No, I'd like to thank both of you for being with me on this news review. Edward Horgan, activist and commentator out of Limerick, Ireland, and Feroz Al-Najm out of Toronto, human rights activist. And thank you for staying with us in another news review.
Moving on to the French capital, Paris, clashes erupt between police and protesters amid nationwide rallies against the government's pension reform plan. Police fired tear gas to disperse the protesters. Workers from different sectors have walked out of their jobs and held demonstrations in the capital and other cities across the country. Refineries have stopped fuel deliveries. Most trains have come to a halt, and power production has decreased during the industrial action. The call for strikes and demonstrations had been given by all major unions. They vowed to bring the country to a standstill. This is the sixth day of nationwide strikes against the planned reform. The government wants to increase the retirement age from 62 to 64, arguing that the change is necessary. Well, Peruvian police have clashed with protesters, venting their anger at the government of President Dina Boluarte in the capital, Lima. Police fired tear gas to disperse the crowd that had gathered in the city's Revolution Square. They were demanding the resignation of Boluarte, the closure of Congress, and changes to the Constitution. The protest held hours after the president gave her testimony to the prosecutor's office. It is investigating the deaths during recent anti-government protests. The South American country plunged into crisis in December, when then-President Pedro Castillo was ousted and arrested for trying to dissolve parliament and rule by decree. His supporters have held numerous demonstrations to press for their demands, including the release of Castillo. About 50 people have been killed and over 1,300 injured in clashes between the police and protesters since then. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
The whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
the supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death, and bestowed life, and made sick, and healed, and made well, and afflicted, and sat upon the throne, and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
The continuing war in Ukraine and the provision of arms by major American arms manufacturers to Kiev is continuing to prolong the war and put huge amounts of profit into the pockets of American arms companies. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. New York Times has covered this story and tells us more. The United States has announced plans to send another shipment of military equipment to Ukraine, comprised mainly of munitions worth about $400 million. Two officials and a third person familiar with the decision, which was announced on Friday, 3rd of March, said the new U.S. military aid shipment to Ukraine will mainly be consisting of guided multiple launch rockets for HIMARS launchers, ammunition for the Bradley fighting vehicles, and armored vehicle launch bridges. The news source confirmed on Thursday, 2nd of March, that the funds for the new military shipment to Ukraine were provided once more by using the Presidential Drawdown Authority, or PDA, by which the President of the United States can legally authorize the shipment of military equipment and services from U.S. stocks without gaining congressional approval in response to an emergency. In this regard, White House spokesperson John Kirby told reporters at an earlier news briefing that he preferred not to put a price tag on the new military shipment to Kiev, saying more details about the contents of the shipment and its estimated value would be released shortly. In the meantime, a confirmed classified Pentagon report revealed the United States has been struggling to keep track of the weapons it sent to forces in Ukraine. U.S. Republican lawmakers have voiced concerns about the haphazard military shipments to Ukraine. Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene said Washington's military aid to Ukraine was a U.S.-led proxy war against Russia. Marjorie Taylor Greene said the Ukraine war had placed a heavy financial burden on the shoulders of American taxpayers, who were already grappling with poverty. However, the lawmaker also admitted that war was a deadly, profitable industry for the U.S. government. The Reuters news agency has also covered this story and tells us more. The United States on Friday, 3rd of March, announced a $400 million new military aid package, which includes weapons, munitions and tactical bridges to move tanks and armored vehicles for Ukraine, deepening its involvement in the war in defiance of repeated warnings by Russia. The bridges could be used by Ukrainian forces that have been training in combined arms maneuver warfare, which is the coordinated use of artillery shelling alongside tank and armored vehicle attack movements in battles with Russian troops since they launched a special operation in Ukraine a year ago. Jack Watling, a senior research fellow for land warfare at the London-based Royal United Services Institute, claimed assault bridging is essential for combined arms operations. It allows armored vehicles to cross narrow rivers and ditches that would otherwise cause a whole force to slow down. Jack Watling added, "Importantly, assault bridges are only critical for offensive operations, showing that the United States is preparing Ukraine to continue the war despite Russia's warnings," which says more U.S. arms aid to Ukraine will only prolong the war. U.S. President Joe Biden has said he expects American aid to Ukraine will continue without interruption, despite opposition by Republicans, who have vowed to use their majority in the House of Representatives to monitor the flow of aid to Ukraine. Russia has repeatedly warned that supplying Kiev with more and more weapons will only exacerbate the conflict, which is now in its 13th month. The Kremlin has said continuously flooding Ukraine with weapons would only drag the conflict out and make it more painful for the Ukrainian side, but it will not change our goals and the end result. Anatoly Antonov, Russia's ambassador to Washington, said recently the U.S. wanted to impose a strategic defeat on Moscow, but would not succeed. Russia's TASS news agency quoted Anatoly Antonov as saying, "All foreign weapons that fall into Ukrainian hands on the battlefield will be ground up and destroyed." The United States has reportedly sent more military assistance to help Ukraine fight against Russia than Washington spent annually to fight its own war in Afghanistan. The data compiled by the German research firm Statista showed that U.S. military aid to Ukraine up to mid-January, covering the first 11 months of the war, totaled $46.6 billion. Citing data from the Kiel Institute for the World Economy, Statista said, compared with an average annual military spending of $43.4 billion in 2022 dollars during the first 10 years of the Afghanistan war. Statista's data journalist, Martin Armstrong, said, "When calculating the average annual costs of previous wars in which the United States has been involved in, the true magnitude of the country's Ukraine aid expenditure can be seen." He said the Ukraine total doesn't include an additional $5 billion worth of weapons and equipment that the Pentagon sent to Kiev. The Foreign Policy magazine has also covered this story and tells us more. The United States' approved arms sales to NATO allies increased dramatically in 2022 compared with 2021, as the war between Russia and Ukraine prompted the member states into purchasing more weapons. By some estimates, military spending by the United States and its allies is growing at a level without precedent since the end of the Second World War. The magazine says the number and cash value of arms sales approved by the United States to its NATO allies has nearly doubled in 2022 compared to 2021. According to an analysis of 2 years of data from the U.S. Defense Department's Defense Security Cooperation Agency, in 2021, the U.S. government approved 14 possible major arms sales to NATO allies, worth around $15.5 billion. However, in 2022, that figure jumped to 24 possible major arms sales worth around $28 billion, including $1.24 billion worth of arms sales to prospective NATO member Finland. The sharp uptick in these arms sales reflects a massive shift in Europe's security landscape. This has been the basis for the generation of vast profits for the arms manufacturers, with the U.S. military-industrial complex emerging as the key beneficiary of the war in Ukraine. Despite conditions in which the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen by 10% for the year as a whole, the share prices of U.S. defense contractors have actually surged. Over the past 12 months, the share price of Northrop Grumman has increased by 40%, and Raytheon is up nearly 17%. While Lockheed Martin's share price has surged by 37%. Some of the approved U.S. arms sales in 2022 were years in the making, such as Germany's plan to purchase F-35 fighter jets in a deal worth around $8.4 billion. In contrast, many other major arms sales were rushed after the war broke out in Ukraine. European countries on NATO's eastern flank dashed to replenish and fully stock their own military capabilities in an effort to replace the equipment they ship to Ukraine and deter Moscow. Any opportunity to supply weapons is profitable to the US military-industrial complex. This incentive is enough for perpetuating the war in Ukraine. Lockheed Martin, the United States' largest military contractor, has booked more than $950 million worth of its own missile military orders from the Pentagon, in part to refill stockpiles being sent to Ukraine. The U.S. Army has awarded Raytheon Technologies more than $2 billion in contracts to deliver missile systems to expand or replenish weapons used in the war in Ukraine.
Congratulations to everyone on 15th of Sha'ban. We here at Arabi English Radio congratulate all our Muslim listeners on the occasion of 15th of Sha'ban, the birth anniversary of the 12th Imam, Al-Qa'im Al-Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance. Congratulations to all our Muslim listeners on this most auspicious occasion.
The Afghanistan Papers.
Part 1.
In terms of capability, there's going to be no circumstance where you see people being lifted off the roof of a embassy in the of the United States from Afghanistan.
Getting out of the U.S. embassy in Afghanistan from the rooftop, what does that exactly mean? August 13, 2021, the U.S. embassy in Kabul, transferring U.S. staff and officials with a helicopter. The fall of Kabul was like the incident that happened 46 years ago in the U.S. Embassy in Vietnam, the incident that was known as the fall of Saigon.
What do you make of this comparison between what's happening in Kabul and Saigon in 1975? I mean, you put them side by side, there it does appear to be a just comparison.
But there was a difference. As U.S. President Joe Biden says, fortunately, during the incidents in Kabul, unlike what happened in Saigon, no one got into a helicopter from the rooftop of the embassy. Before the exit, all of the documents were burnt. Untold stories are usually more important than those that have been revealed. It rarely happens that someone can get access to classified documents, and when the confidential documents are disposed, it's like they never existed. But is there a way for the public to find out about the truth? Maybe the media are the only way. A media outlet reveals secrets depending on the degree of its independence. In 2019, the Washington Post published a part of the secret documents on the U.S. presence in Afghanistan. The documents were known as the Afghanistan Papers. A curious journalist at the Washington Post, Craig Whitlock, a person who had been investigating Afghanistan for a while and had been gathering documents. He published several thousand pages of documents, including interviews with scores of U.S. generals and diplomats on security issues. But how did Whitlock manage to do that?
2,000 pages of documents of interviews that had been kept under wraps for a number of years, in which people who were in charge of the war admitted that the strategy was a mess, that they misled the American public.
This important event happened after he got to know Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, SIGAR, an organization that was established by the U.S. Congress in 2008 to inspect the reconstruction in Afghanistan. General John Sopko is the head and special inspector of the organization. John Sopko is the most important U.S. figure in the reconstruction of Afghanistan. He agreed to gradually leak some documents to the Washington Post in his cooperation with Craig Whitlock from 2007.
Of any inspector general, I've probably been the most forthcoming on information.
The revelations by John Sopko on the process of reconstruction in Afghanistan during the 20 years were a clear example of burnt documents. Despite its economic capacities, Afghanistan is among the weakest economies in the world. Afghanistan was among the poorest countries in the world until 2020, if not the poorest country. Poverty is a natural outcome of poor economy and long-running wars in a country.
Afghanistan is the poorest country in Asia. In fact, it is the poorest country in the world, except for about 5 to 8, depending on how you measure it, countries in Africa.
In Under such circumstances, it isn't surprising that the country has been ranked the first or second country with the highest rate of immigration during these years. U.S.'s construction project was apparently an answer to the ruins in Afghanistan and was meant to prove that the U.S. has brought prosperity to any country it's entered. Based on an official report by SIGAR, the U.S. spent $143 billion until 2021 for Afghan reconstruction.
America's $143 billion investment in Afghan's reconstruction.
Yet, living conditions in Afghanistan continue to remain critical. So what happened to the whopping budget? The answer to the question has to do with the companies and contractors that have received the money from the U.S. government. So we have to look into the matter a little to see what exactly John Supko, the Special Inspector of Afghan Reconstruction, has faced. One of the most important factors in the poverty crisis of a country is food insecurity. Based on a report by the Center for Strategic and International Studies, CSIS, Afghanistan was among the 10 countries in the world with the worst food insecurity condition in 2020.
Increasing it of those that are food insecure. As I said, we were already estimating 14 million. Now we're up to 20 million with a drought.
The biggest food problem in Afghanistan is a lack of protein. Meat or dairy products do not exist sufficiently in this poor country. On the other hand, the poor Afghan society cannot buy American products. But in a long-term reconstruction plan, the country can become a consumer of American agri-products.
That we produce a lot more food than we can consume. And so it's critical for us to find markets abroad and foreign assistance and the Food for Peace program and so many other programs like it.
Soybean, as a complete plant protein, was an investment with future in sight. The U.S. started investing on it in Afghanistan in 2003.
Soybean is a good tool for fighting malnutrition for them, and then it also helps us in our goals to build the agribusiness sector and create jobs and to legitimize the government of Afghanistan.
In fact, the Pentagon paved the ground so a U.S. organization can develop soybean production in Afghanistan. Nutrition and Education International, also known as NEI, that's N-E-I, based in Pasadena, California. The company's CEO is Stephen Kwan. He is one of the former managers of Nestle in the U.S. Nestle is the largest food company in the world. Kwan got involved in the Afghan food industry in 2003. At the beginning, his company was mostly like a charity.
When I first heard about so many women and children are dying in this country due to malnutrition, I felt that I should do something. As a person who is in charge of a nutritional program.
Besides the Pentagon and the NEI, the U.S. Department of Agriculture also got involved in the strategic field of food in Afghanistan.
We not only have to win this on the ground, we have to win it in the ground.
Along the lines of this policy, the American Soybean Association, the ASA, supported by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, signed contracts with the Afghan officials.
I am Jim Hershey. I'm the executive.
Jim Hershey, as a representative of the Soybean Association, along with Stephen Kwan, was among the most important U.S. figures who entered the Afghan food industry. Jim's goal was to link soybean consumption in Afghanistan to the ASA in the long run.
Accessible, available, affordable, and acceptable.
The NEI and the ASA were after bigger advantages in Afghan reconstruction that would lead to bigger contracts. The interaction between Stephen Kwan and Jim Hershey led to a major contract with the U.S. Agriculture Department.
Is protein deficient? There's not enough protein in the market. There's not enough protein in some of the households.
A project that was worth $26 million to develop soybean production in Afghanistan. But the contract was only a part of the soybean fund for Afghanistan. After 2003, the American Soybean Association and the NEI got bigger funds, whose total amounted to $34 million. But in 2014, the Center for Public Integrity said the U.S. soybean project in Afghanistan was a complete failure. The center said the reasons for the failure of the project were adverse weather conditions in Afghanistan and lack of the necessary infrastructure.
And finally, a multi-million dollar project to cultivate soybeans in Afghanistan seemed like a good idea 4 years ago. But an IG report obtained by the Center for Public Integrity shows the project may have been doomed to fail from the get-go.
But according to a report by the Center for Public Integrity, the most important reason for the failure was soybean had no room in the food culture of the Afghan people. Afghans don't like soybeans.
And very important to us is underutilization, is the acceptability. Is the food tasty?
In this line, Americans took various measures to make soybean acceptable for Afghan society. Soybean was used to produce bread for the people in Afghanistan under the brand Strong Bread, and widespread advertisement was made to find a place for soybean in the people's nutrition. But getting to know about the challenges of the project in Afghanistan, especially for U.S. institutions, was not a daunting task. Then why didn't they choose a replacement for the soybean? Soybean had no background in Afghanistan, neither its production nor its consumption. Under such circumstances, it was natural that this question might rise: what happened to the $34 million? This is a question that the ASA has to answer. The soybean project, without achieving any good results, kept Afghanistan among the three most food insecure countries in the world. In the end, the U.S. food project failed with a superficial answer to a major question.
The Afghans don't grow soy. They have no market for soy. They don't eat soy. They don't like soy. You know? So what a great idea. Let's create a program for the Afghans. So the fields to grow the soy are up here. There's no milling process. It's down here. There are no roads connecting. What do you think happens after 2 years? $36 million go out of gets wasted.
The reconstruction projects were not limited to food programs in Afghanistan. Expanding an electricity grid was among the main reconstruction goals. Afghan officials had posed serious questions regarding electricity. From self-sufficiency in production to even exporting to regional countries. But in a strange paradox, at the end of the reconstruction era, power crisis in Afghanistan became so critical that in 2020, speculations were rife that the Afghan power generation network cannot even supply itself with electricity. In 2013, 30% of the people in Afghanistan had electricity. In 2020, only 35% of the people enjoyed electricity in a standard way. This is while Afghanistan has sufficient oil and gas to fuel power plants and also has vast rivers for construction of dams and generation of electricity. The most serious problem of lack of electricity in the country was attributed to power outages in Kabul, the Afghan capital. This is while two U.S. companies, namely Black & Veatch with Van Dyke as the CEO and Louis Berger, headed by Larry Walker, were tasked with supplying Kabul with electricity.
Thank you both.
Besides the two companies, there was another renowned company, Symbion Power, whose CEO is Paul Hinks, Now, Symbion Power joined the two former companies as a contractor. The three companies signed a contract in 2006 to reconstruct a gas-fired power plant, but political developments knocked the project off course. The 2009 presidential election was approaching, and the people were suffering from the insufficient power supply. Under such circumstances, it was only natural that power outages in Kabul would turn into a political issue, an issue that Western powers of then-President Karzai knew how sensitive it was.
The campaign had just started to re-elect Karzai, and people were looking into what Karzai has done, and that question became very loud in many people's minds that they haven't been able to bring power to Kabul.
The government that they had brought to Afghanistan could not even provide Kabul with sufficient electricity. So, Karzai's political campaign, with the then U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, Ronald Newman, at the center stage, decided that the power plant should be established before the 2009 election, no matter what.
We were going to have a presidential election, so there was an issue of politics. But there was also an issue of whether power was needed, which it was, and could be done in a feasible way.
Meanwhile, in 2007, a plot of land in an area called Tarakhel near Kabul was earmarked for construction of the power plant. Carl Eikenberry was U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan between 2009 and 2011. He was somehow the successor to former envoy Ronald Newman's project. So, in a tight and unrealistic schedule, a power plant which was supposed to be fueled by gas immediately changed into diesel fuel. Carl Eikenberry knocked the project together in 2009. On August 5th, 2009, he and Karzai inaugurated the Kabul power plant with the minimum capacity for generation of electricity. It was exactly 15 days before the presidential election, which was held on August 20th. Considering this, it was a noteworthy schedule, 2 weeks before the election, so people would exactly remember who cares about their electricity. The project kickstarted with an estimated $100 million fund, but it was completed in 2010 with over $300 million spent.
And this was done in December of 2010 against a backdrop of AIDs having complained vociferously a number of times about your performance under the 2006 contract to provide power to Kabul, that the contract originally was projected to cost $100 million. It ballooned to $300 million. There were also overruns in terms of time.
Eventually, Carl Eikenberry completed and handed over the power plant in Kabul to the Afghan government in 2014 in a splendid takeover ceremony. But the power plant was handed over to the Afghan government in a situation that, instead of using Afghan gas reserves, imported diesel was used to feed the plant. Under those circumstances, in 2010, the cost of diesel was so high that importing electricity from neighboring countries would cost much less for Afghanistan.
We are not using it because we have enough power from abroad and it is cheaper. This power plant is too expensive for us.
In the end, until 2020, the power plant failed to completely supply Kabul with electricity due to the exorbitant costs of diesel, because it was working only at 1% of its capacity. The $300 million project was known as the white elephant in Kabul due to its unending problems. The power plant was also known as the most expensive power plant on the planet. The politicization of electricity supply in Kabul created the best atmosphere for three power plant construction companies. They needed to provide a justification for the power plant, which was supposed to generate electricity with gas, but turned into a diesel power plant, and afterwards it went almost bankrupt. but they admitted that the power plant project completely failed.
Mr. Hanks, you were signed up as a subcontractor on the famous Kabul power plant, yes?
Yes, sir.
Now, that came in at about $300 million. Is that what it should have cost?
Not in my opinion, sir.
It is obvious that they could not admit that the power plant turned into a diesel-run power plant because of the 2009 presidential race. So the best option was to blame someone else for the failure of the project, or say they could not reveal some realities due to security issues.
In Afghanistan, Symbion was engaged as a subcontractor by Louis Berger and Black & Veatch for the construction of a 100-megawatt power plant, a power plant you all know a lot about. The subcontract wound up in a dispute and is now in arbitration proceedings. Unfortunately, because of a confidentiality order, which I opposed, I am prohibited from discussing details that relate to the dispute.
Larry Walker, the CEO of Louis Berger, was already notorious for many other failed projects in the past. Road construction was among Louis Berger's most outstanding, incomplete projects in Afghanistan. The New York Times described that Louis Berger projects in Afghanistan failed from the get-go.
Parts of the highway that you have already constructed is deteriorating, and if so, is your firm paying for the repairs to that stretch of road, or is USAID and the taxpayer picking up the tab?
First, I would absolutely disagree with that reporter's assessment. The reporter was referring to one particular crack that was on the road.
The challenge of bad roads, or totally lack of them, had caused other problems in other parts of Afghanistan. In 2008, the USAID devised a mega-scale road construction plan across Afghanistan, but the outcome did not even fulfill 10% of the objectives of the initial plan.
That they started doing in 2008, 2009. The USAID and the State Department invested $400 million in a project that was supposed to build 1,200 miles of roads across the country. Cut to 3 years later, they've built 100 miles of road, and they spent more than $200 million, more than half of the money.
Oh, wow.
Besides lack of roads in the country, where most of the people live in rural areas, shortage of hospitals in Afghanistan is one of the most important challenges. Furthermore, lack of medical equipment is among major crises the hospitals in Afghanistan face. Just like many hospitals that don't have the necessary equipment, many schools do not have the necessary infrastructure and do not have teachers.
The Limelight.
The European Union's support for the Israeli regime has become more extreme in recent times. One ghastly case of that extremism involved the Brussels bureaucracy halting aid to Palestinians with cancer and other serious illnesses. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of the Electronic Intifada wrote in this regard, Olivier Varhaley, Hungary's member of the European Commission, the EU's executive, is the main culprit. During 2021 and much of last year, he vetoed the release of around $230 million in funding earmarked for the Palestinian Authority. Among the many consequences was that large numbers of medical patients were denied treatment. The sole reason cited by Varhaley for his obstructive behavior was that he did not like what Palestinian children were being taught at school. Almost all aid had to be frozen. By his reasoning, because a few textbooks were not sufficiently differential towards the Zionist regime. Documents obtained through a Freedom of Information request provide some context on his wanton cruelty.